So are you ready, Olivia?
I'm ready.
Okay.
I am.
All right. Excellent. Would that I could say the same. Well, let's go ahead and pretend that I am ready. So first question, Olivia, what inspired you to write The Trip to Echo Spring?
I grew up in an alcoholic family myself, and when I was 17, I read Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, Tennessee Williams' Pulitzer Prize-winning play, and it was the first time I'd encountered something about the alcoholic family, about the dynamics of the alcoholic family, and I was just so struck by it. I was absolutely obsessed with it, and that sort of began my interest in alcohol and literature. And as I got older, I realised that many of these writers who wrote so eloquently about alcohol suffered from alcoholism themselves. So it began to seem that there was this large untold story about the ways in which alcohol and literature intermingled, entwined, and I wanted to get to grips with that.
Mm. Yeah, and speaking of the Tennessee Williams play Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, that's actually where you got the title of your book from, The Trip to Echo Spring, isn't it?
It is, yeah. So the drinker, Brick, who's a retired, young retired sports hero, he's injured his leg, drunk on the sports field the night before and a few nights before maybe. And he keeps, it's all set in one house, and he keeps going to the liquor cabinet over and over again. And his wife, Maggie the Cat, who was so memorably played by Elizabeth Taylor, keeps saying, "What are you doing, Brick?" And he says, "I'm making a little short trip to Echo Spring." And Echo Spring is the name of a Kentucky bourbon. It's a real drink, but it's also his nickname for the liquor cabinet. And more than that, it's something symbolic, I think. It's something that seemed to me to capture the more symbolic act that people are doing when they're drinking, this idea of escaping to some place of quiet, some place that's far away. And that was what I really wanted to get to grips with. I wanted to know what that place was, what it meant, and what the consequences of going there were.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You mentioned that you grew up in an alcoholic family, Olivia. Can you tell me a bit about that?
Sure, I can. I touch on it very lightly, really, in the book. I didn't want to put lots of it in, and also it was actually incredibly hard to write about. It was really quite painful to write about. But when I was about, I guess, six or so, my mother got together with a partner who was a drinker, and the drinking got out of control. And there was a period of a couple of years where it became very, very frightening in my home environment. And that experience of seeing the utter transformation that drink can wreak on a person just, I mean, it was terrifying. It was also fascinating. And it left me, when I've encountered the myth of writers and drinking, it's never seemed to really take in what an alcoholic is really like. And so that's kind of what I wanted to demythologize that sense of the glorious drinking writer and to bring in some of the larger sense of what alcoholism does and the havoc it wreaks on the physical body, on the emotions, on the ability to create, and on the lives of everyone who the drinker loves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you write very vividly about one incident in which your mother's partner at that time was really out of control, and there was a fire involved and the police were called. Can you tell me a bit about that?
Yeah, that, that was a dark day in my family's history. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing about that is we never talked in all the intervening years about this period. So I had a kind of deeply buried memory that I spent a lot of time trying to sort of exhume of this night when everything went crazy, the police were called, it was all very frightening. And then when I was working on the book, my mother travelled on part of the trip with me, and so I brought it up, which was actually quite frightening to do, and said, you know, what did you think happened that night, Mum? And her story was totally different, and I hadn't remembered any of it. And that seemed very interesting to me as well, because this idea of both denial, which is such an active force in alcoholism and in everyone around an alcoholic, but also slippage of memories, loss of memories, changing memories. My experience of that was very visceral, but it was also interesting looking at how that worked in all of the six writers that I was looking at as well.
Mm-hmm. And you focus on six American writers: F. Scott Fitzgerald, Ernest Hemingway, Tennessee Williams, John Berryman, John Cheever, and Raymond Carver. Why did you choose these particular six writers?
I knew from the beginning that Tennessee Williams had to be there, that my connection to him and his work was very important. And then I wanted people who had a kind of commonality. I wanted this book to have a coherence and not just be a sort of series of separate portraits. So I needed people who either knew each other, like Hemingway and Fitzgerald knew each other, or people who were interested in each other. Like John Berryman was very interested in Ernest Hemingway. He felt that they had things in common and he was fascinated by him. The other thing that's important to say is that I wanted people whose work I genuinely thought was marvellous, because I was going to be drawing out all of these difficult elements of their lives, because I was going to be handling stuff that was so unpleasant, these scenes of real kind of wreckage. I didn't just want to write a hatchet job. I didn't want to write this sort of cruel, exposing book. And I wanted to have that as the kind of antidote. I wanted to be able to present them at their best as well as at their absolute worst.
Mm. Yeah. And you didn't include any women writers. Did you think about that at all? Did you consider using any?
I absolutely did, yeah. And I'm aware that I could have written basically the same book about six women writers. I could have looked at people like Jean Rousseau, I think is an incredible writer. I could have looked at Elizabeth Bishop. I could have looked at Marguerite Duras, again, who's one of my favourite writers. And I think the story would have been slightly different and, again, very interesting, because female drinking is much less socially sanctioned and in the 20th century even more so. And almost deviant, so much less glamorized, I think. And the reason I didn't do that is because I had such strong experiences of a female alcoholic in my own childhood. It felt too close to the bone. I wasn't capable of doing it. Mm. And I do hope somebody does it, because I think it would be a wonderful book. But it wasn't for me to do.
Right, I see. Now, is it possible to say that the six writers you profiled, Fitzgerald, Hemingway, Williams, Berryman, Cheever, and Carver, used alcohol for similar reasons? Or were there any common denominators in the reasons that they drank?
I think there are common denominators, absolutely. The interesting thing, and one of the sort of first myths that I realised wasn't quite true, is that people tend to write drunk. And actually, that happened very rarely. Fitzgerald did it sometimes and often regretted having to do it. But mostly they were using drink for other reasons. And I think I can probably summarise those. Partly it was to do with, at the end of a working day, people like Hemingway, for example, like to start drinking as a way of changing the channel, as a way of letting off the pressure of the day, of that sort of incredibly focused work that he was doing, mm-hmm. which is something that I'm sure worked very well at the beginning of his life and later on had far bleaker consequences. But then, and much more importantly, I think, there's a way in which drinking was used as self-medication, and you see that with almost all of them. In fact, I think all of them, that they suffered, and often from a very young age, from things like anxiety, social unease, depression. And drinking was, in the beginning, an almost magical key to a more confident, competent, almost weightless self, somebody that wasn't burdened by these feelings that they felt themselves so burdened by. And you see that very clearly with somebody like Tennessee Williams, who used to suffer from really bad panic attacks. He'd often think that he was literally going to go mad from his panic attacks. And of course, his sister did go mad. So it wasn't a sort of a random fear. And once he started drinking, once he got to grips with drinking, he realised that he was this passport out of these terrible feelings that he was experiencing. And the problem with that, of course, is that alcohol is an addictive, poisonous substance. It works very well initially, but because of its effect on the brain, the brain adjusts to it, and when you take it away, all of those feelings of anxiety come crowding back, and you need more drink and more drink and more drink to stop it.
Mm-hmm. And John Cheever also used alcohol in many ways to deal with his social anxiety, didn't he?
He absolutely did, yeah. He did suffer from social anxiety. The other thing that goes on with John Cheever is that he was married. He'd come from quite a poor background and invented this sort of very middle-class, waspy life for himself. He lived in Ossining. He was very sort of well-bred seeming. And that didn't square with what his actual sexual desires were, which was for men, that he was drawn to men. He wanted to love men. He didn't feel himself able to do that. And his drinking seems so much tied into that, that it's a way of constantly needing to suppress the self that he found absolutely unbearable, which I think is incredibly sad.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Absolutely. Your book is also part travelogue. You traveled by plane and train across the U.S. to visit Cheever's New York and Raymond Carver's Port Angeles in the Pacific Northwest, among other places. Why did you think that, or why did you want to actually visit these places to write your book?
Partly I wanted to see them. But there's another reason too, which is that all of these writers loved landscape. It mattered to them a great deal, I think. And they wrote about it incredibly beautifully, both in their fictions and in their own letters, in their diaries. And if you think of things like Hemingway on trout fishing or deep sea fishing, or particularly Raymond Carver's late poetry, which is so in love with the landscape around Port Angeles, he really felt that that landscape sustained him in his sobriety, that it had a lot to do with how he'd managed to get sober. And it seemed to me that that brought out something that was very good in them. That was a side of them that was very pure. And while I was handling all of this other material, all of this stuff about hitting wives or fighting with children or falling out with friends, all of these things that they were doing in their lives, I felt it was really important to preserve that other sense of them that was going on at the same time, of this goodness, this ability to describe, this desire to describe, this love. And the best way I could think of doing that was to look at the places that they'd loved.
Mm-hmm. At one point in the trip to Echo Spring, you write that by traveling through these various locations in sequence, you thought that it would be possible to build a kind of topographical map of alcoholism. And that's such a beautiful, evocative phrase. What do you mean by that, Olivia?
Well, there'd been other books about alcoholism writers, and they tended to be structured in terms of one portrait after another portrait after another portrait. And I noticed that there was a similar trajectory in all of those, that they'd start sort of the early carefree, light-hearted days of drinking, and then gradually the alcoholism would gather and would start becoming much more addictive, much more dangerous, and then you'd end up with these deaths. And I thought, well, if all of these stories have the same arc, then maybe it's the arc that I want to look at. And that's what I tried to do, and I wanted to plot that out across the country. So in New York, I'm looking at these early days of drinking, these sort of intoxicating days of drinking. And as I travel down to Florida, through New Orleans to Florida, I'm looking much more about the alcoholism as it starts to hit, and Tennessee Williams' last awful years, and what happened to Hemingway, which we all know is just a complete tragedy. I moved on up to St. Paul, and that's really where the book reaches its sort of nadir, is dealing with the poet John Berryman, who committed suicide there. And then I travel on to Port Angeles to really look at the recovery stories of the people who managed to get sober and who managed to draw back these extraordinary second lives. And that's where I handle the material that's about John Cheever, but particularly Raymond Carver.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk in detail about a few of the writers. John Cheever, what role did alcohol play in his creative process?
At the beginning, I think that there's many answers to that. Alcohol is so much a part of Cheever's stories. It's a prop in his stories. And I think it was a prop in his life as well. It was some kind of intrinsic part of this civilized life that he aspired to and that he absolutely describes in those wonderful New Yorker stories that he wrote. So you have this kind of shady hills and everybody's drinking martinis and it's all very glamorous and a little bit debauched. And that's how Cheever's life was. And then the drinking started getting worse. And you see in his diaries this epic, almost operatic battle day by day, where he's fighting with himself about, will I be able to last until 11 o'clock today before I drink? Or will it be 10? Will it be 9? My hands are shaking. I feel like the panic of the world has come upon me. I mean, really, he's in a very bad way. And he'll talk about sneaking into the pantry to have a scoop of gin, and if his family are there, it's too shameful to do that, so he'll jump in the car and drive to the liquor store, take the lid off the bottle and start swigging it on a back street. I mean, he is a desperate addict at that point. So that sort of, it finds its way into his stories, and then gradually his stories start becoming damaged by it. I think there's less and less of them. And then in his sobriety, because he does manage to get sober, he writes what I think is his greatest novel, Faulkner, and that's very much about his experiences of recovery, his experience of addiction, his experiences of recovery. It's a very beautiful book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of the short stories that his battle with alcohol finds its way into is his 1964 classic, The Swimmer. And you write in your book that the swimmer catches in its strange compressions the full arc of an alcoholic's life. How does Cheever do that?
It's such a wonderful, strange story. It's about a man who decides to swim home from a party by way of his neighbor's swimming pools, which is such a wonderful idea.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a single day, but it also isn't. The weather seems to change, the climate seems to change, it seems to become winter. He's at first greeted with great friendliness by his neighbours, and gradually with more and more hostility. There are abandoned houses, things seem to have gone through some strange change that he doesn't quite understand. And by the end of the story, he finds himself at his own house, but it's empty. Nobody's lived there for a long time. And it's clear from little hints that are dropped throughout the story that he is an alcoholic, that he has gone through the losses that many alcoholics go through, that he's estranged from his children and his wife. And it seems to catch in a very few pages the entirety of that nosedive that alcohol can take somebody through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's very well said. Sorry, just give me a second here. I'm going to catch my train of thought. Yeah, one thing you noticed and that you mentioned in the book that you've noticed is this idea of this dream of letting go into water. It's something that is found in the work of a lot of alcoholic writers. And the swimmer, John Cheever's story, is perhaps the most famous example. Can you think of another example?
It seemed to be, I'd find it sometimes in letters. There's a letter that Hemingway wrote about diving down into the water in Florida and thinking, I might just let go, I might just stay down here. And then he remembered that he had three sons and came back up to the surface. And it's there in stories, it's there in many of Fitzgerald's stories. There's a wonderful one about a man who is married to somebody that he dislikes, as Fitzgerald sometimes felt that he was. And it ends with him literally just swimming away. And I think that they all loved swimming. They all loved the water. And I think that desire to just swim away has so much to do with why people drink, to just glide out of it, to just be lifted out of it.
Yeah.
And, of course, it is not as scot-free as it sounds because it comes with these awful consequences. But it's easy to understand where that urge comes from, I think.
Uh-huh. Yeah, very, very well said. Of the six writers you feature in the trip to Echo Spring, which writer's story do you think is the most tragic?
Clearly what happened to John Berryman, who ended up killing himself. He committed suicide jumping off a bridge after going through recovery three times and realising he just couldn't find it in himself to get sober. That was a very tragic story. But the one that touched me the most, I think, is Tennessee Williams, who I absolutely adore. And the reason for that is Tennessee, his drinking was in a very bad place, probably by the 60s, maybe even a little earlier. His beloved partner, Frank Merlo, died of cancer. And after that, I mean, they were estranged anyway before. And after that, Tennessee went into what he described as his stoned age. And he really, an inelegant way of putting it is he really lost the plot. And the thing that I find very moving about his life is that he got sober again after that and then carried on drinking again. So he never quite achieved sobriety, but he never stops working. And if you think about Tennessee Williams' life and his body of work, after something like Night of the Iguana, which comes after Cat and Art to Move, Streetcar Named Desire, the sort of the big famous plays, his plays become much more difficult. They're damaged by the alcohol he's been taking. And the critics hate them. The critics absolutely savage him. His plays start failing, audiences drop off. He really goes through these serial humiliations and he never stops writing. He gets up every morning, he drinks his black coffee, he sits down at the typewriter and he works. And there's something about that work ethic, there's something about that desire to create, despite how agonizing he's finding the experience of his creation's recognition, that I found really deeply moving.
Mm-hmm. Did you uncover any evidence, Olivia, that he, as his plays, his later plays, met with the poor reviews, did he drink more heavily? Did you find anything out about that?
His drinking, yeah, it just gets worse and worse and worse. And he knew even very early on in his diaries, there's this extraordinary entry where he says, the play I'm working on is being damaged by my drinking. I know it is. I can't stop because my anxiety is so bad that if I stop, I'll go crazy. But I know it's affecting my work. It's affecting structure. It's affecting coherence. All those things did start happening later. But the play he's talking about is Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, which is structurally perfect. So he knew, even at that early stage, that he was really on a very dangerous road. And I think his experience of just being Tennessee Williams, his experience of being Tom Williams, his experience of inhabiting his own body was so difficult for him that you can see where the drinking comes in, but the drinking made it a billion times worse.
Yeah, that's amazing. I'd forgotten, even though I've read your whole book, I'd forgotten that I was about to ask you what play that was, and thinking it was going to be one of the later plays. And yeah, and that's amazing that it was one of his classics, a relatively early play. Yeah, let's talk a bit about Raymond Carver. What role did alcohol play in his life and work?
Raymond Carver is different because the others, I think, drank in ways that seemed closely related. Raymond Carver comes from a very different background. He's much poorer than the rest. Mm-hmm. He married very, very young. I think he was 16 or 17. And he had children almost immediately, and two children almost immediately. So his wife had only just given birth to the first when she got pregnant with the second. So he was a young, very intelligent man who knew he wanted to be a writer with these financial burdens that are absolutely weighing down upon him. And I mean, the poverty of their early lives cannot be exaggerated. They really were absolutely broke, constantly in debt for hospital bills for the babies before they'd even begun. So never being able to catch up. He wanted to write. That's what he wanted to do. And I think there was so much bitterness around that. I think there was so much frustration around that, that really drove his drinking. His father had drunk a lot as well. And I think that's where it comes in. And obviously, at some point, the addiction itself just kicks in, and then it's almost pointless to be explaining what sort of starts it off. But I think that was a big part of it for him.
Mm-hmm. And alcohol really, even literally, served as a muse for his poem. He wrote a poem called Alcohol, didn't he?
I mean, it's there in so many of his stories, and he wrote that wonderful Where I'm Calling From, which is about his experiences in recovery. You know, and it's transmuted into fiction, but it's very much drawing from his own experience. And what's interesting with Carver is when he did manage to get dry, it was just after he'd sold his first novel, which he never ended up writing, but it was almost as if he needed that confirmation that, hey, Ray, you're a writer, and here's money for it. Yeah. And then somehow he could shrug it off.
Yeah. Cheever and Raymond Carver were the only two of the six that you profile in your book who were able to give up alcohol. How did they succeed while the other four failed?
Oh, it's the great mystery, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think luck and determination are probably the best answers, because John Berryman tried extremely hard to give up. I think there has to be some sort of foundation of self-belief, perhaps, some ability to have faith. Faith is such an important thing in the AA process. And I think Cheever and Carver both managed to discover that in themselves, managed to hold on to the process. And John Berryman couldn't. And he wrote this unfinished novel, Recovery, which was based very closely on his own recovery experience. It's clear he tried very hard. It's clear he understood what was required of him, but couldn't find it inside himself. I think it is a real mystery how people manage to get sober, even having spent so much time studying it.
Yeah. I'm curious about how sobering up affected John Cheever and Raymond Carver's fiction. John Cheever's novel, The Faulkner, which you mentioned earlier, was he sober when he wrote that?
He was sober when he wrote that, and it's wonderful looking at his letters from... He was at the Smithers Institute in New York. That's where he went to get sober, which is also where Truman Capote went, actually. And he just felt this kind of glee about this idea. He writes about it a lot when he's supposed to be really focusing on his own recovery. But, I mean, he's a writer. That's what he does.
Sure.
And it's about a heroin addict who's very similar to Cheever in sort of character and background. He has lots of little experiences from Cheever's own life, and he manages to escape, and the fact that it's set in a prison, the fact that he escapes from the prison at the end, are so tied up with each other. And I think that's really how Cheever felt about it, that he had escaped from a prison. And it ends with this wonderful thing where he hides in a body bag and he's carried out, and he says how marvellous it is to be carried as an adult. And I think there's something in that about the AA fellowship. It's people extending a hand of help. It's people who know where you've been extending a hand of help. And I wonder how much that's kind of connected to that image of being carried out in a body bag.
Yeah, there probably is a connection there, yeah. Well, what about in the case of Raymond Carver? After he sobered up, did his fiction change?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. This is a story tied up partly in the role of Gordon Lish, in his editor in Carver's life. And, I mean, this is quite a well-known story now, but Raymond Carver was around the time that he just got out of recovery, he put together the story collection that's called What We Talk About When We Talk About Love, which obviously became incredibly successful. Mm-hmm. And those stories started out as very generous, very positive, almost a little sentimental. And his editor, Gordon Lish, went through them with a very, very red pen and took out huge amounts. And Carver felt that that was physically detrimental to his sobriety. He thought that he could go back to drinking again. The stories felt that intimately engaged with his sobriety. And obviously Lish won that argument, and the stories that were published and that did incredibly well were his versions. But after that, Carver carried on that track of things that were just slightly more generous, slightly softer than his early work. And you see that in the stories. You see that in something like Errand, which is the wonderful one about Chekhov's death. Mm. But you also see that in the amazing poetry he wrote. He was living out in Port Angeles. He was married by then to Tess Gallagher, who's the poet. And his poetry becomes very generous, very grateful, very thankful, very attentive to moments of beauty. And it seems to me, I mean, I'm not saying he was a completely transformed character or absolutely perfect in every aspect, but his work seems to me to demonstrate the kind of enlargement that sobriety can bring.
Mm, yeah. So taking a larger, a longer, more distant view of this, Olivia, what did you learn about the relationship between alcohol and creativity? Does it serve as a source of inspiration, or is it a source of destruction, or does it function as both, depending on the writer?
I guess it functions as both. I think the thing is that I don't believe alcohol long-term is a creative substance. I think it's profoundly decreative. But the thing that I'm more interested in is the ways in which alcohol and creativity seem to come from a similar sort of starting place, that they seem to derive from a similar sort of desire to make sense of, to handle, to repress, to transform the material of early life. And I mean, that's obviously not the only cause of alcoholism, but it's certainly part of it. And that's what I'm really intrigued by. And you see this in John Cheever, that he talks about the desire to drink and the desire for fantasy and how similar they are and how much they're driven by these early life experiences.
Mm-hmm. What about for you personally, Olivia? Do you drink at all? And if so, does alcohol in any way serve as a muse for you?
I do drink. I drink, I mean, this is where I think the idea that alcoholism is genetic really comes in. I'm aware that despite my many experiences with alcoholism, it's not something that I think will affect me. I don't feel prone to that, but I enjoy drinking, and I'm certainly not judgmental about people's drinking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'd like to end by having you read a passage from your book. It's about your visit to Raymond Carver's grave. And
yeah,
you, if you can set it up a bit.
I will do.
Thank you.
So at the very end of the book, I travel to Port Angeles. I spend some time there. And the last thing I do before I leave is go to Raymond Carver's grave, which is just outside the town of Port Angeles. This is on the Olympic Peninsula, which is a very beautiful, mountainous piece of land on the Juan de Fuca Strait. Under a bench, I found the black metal box I'd heard about. I opened it and pulled out a Ziploc bag. Inside was a spiral-bound notebook. I squatted down on the grass and started reading. The sun was streaming through the trees in dusty shafts, stirrable as honey. It was a visitor's book, each entry written in a different hand. Gallagher used it the most, but there were also many letters from strangers and old friends. Some wanted to say how much Carver's writing meant to them, and others talked about addiction in tones that sounded as if they were speaking to a priest or an AA sponsor, someone non-judgmental and sympathetic. Spending is an escape, just like alcohol, one read. We are all trying to fill that empty hole. Another. I started drinking, hard. If I can keep my head above water, hopefully I won't drown. I turned 23 yesterday. Tess had scribbled a reply to that one. Ray would say, have faith, grasp at straws, and go to AA. I was crying by then. Faith. In the end, recovery depends on faith, of one kind or another. Carver once said he didn't believe in God, But I have to believe in miracles and the possibility of resurrection, no question about that. Every day that I wake up, I'm glad to wake up. It's this faith that became explicit in his late stories, Cathedral, Errand, Intimacy, though there are traces of it in things he wrote much earlier too. It struck me then that by driving out to a writer's grave, all these anonymous, suffering strangers were putting their faith in stories, in the capacity of literature to somehow salve a sense of soreness, to make one feel less flinchingly alone. I thought of myself as a child, of how I became a reader because tracts of my life were unendurable. In 1969, 6 years before he got sober, John Cheever was asked by the Paris Review if he felt godlike at the typewriter. Perhaps you could read his answer as a delusion, the word Berryman scratched all through the proofs of his own interview. Perhaps it wasn't, though. Perhaps it could be taken at face value. No, I've never felt godlike. No, the senses of one's total usefulness. We all have a power of control. It's part of our lives. We have it in love, in work that we love doing. It's a sense of ecstasy, as simple as that. The sense is, this is my usefulness and I can do it all the way through. It always leaves you feeling great. In short, you've made sense of your life.
That was great. That was wonderful, Olivia. Thank
brilliant.
You so much.
Thank
that
you.
Was brilliant. Thank you. Anything you wanted to add, or was there any question you wished I'd asked?
No, that felt really, really thorough, really great.
Yeah. Okay, great. Yeah, thank you. That was wonderful. And great. Your reading was fantastic.